What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
By the way, I wanted to tell, I forgot, there's a joke I want to tell you. I thought you'd appreciate it because of your love of history. Mm-hmm. So it's World War II, and the Italian army and the German army, they're in the forest, and the Allies are on their way, and they're surrounded. They have no chance. They're definitely going to be defeated and killed, right? So the German general says to his, second-in-command? Who's okay. The German general says to his second-in-command, "Bring me mine red jacket." And the Italian general says to the German guy, why do you say that? He goes, because I don't want my men to see me bleed. And the Italian guy goes, okay. Italian general says to his second in command, bring me my brown pants. Which I told that joke when I was like a little kid in front of a group of adults. And I told it the other way. Because I didn't get the political, historical ramifications, right? So I told it so that the Italian guy had said...
It's always got to be the Italian.
Yeah, the Italians are shitting themselves, right? Yeah.
It's so funny. In Rome, they've got that gigantic war memorial next to the Colosseum. And it's just like, dude, come on. How long has it been? Like, you know, it's been about 2,000 years.
Hello, and welcome to Katie Helper Show. I'm your host, Katie Helper, joined by...
What's going on, everybody? It's me, Gabe Pacheco. All right.
How you doing, Mr. President?
Feeling great.
This week, we talk to Matt Chrisman, who you may have heard of. He's from the Chapo Trap House podcast.
Talks about fascism in Italy
Germany. And why the horseshoe theory is BS and... You know, what's going to happen in 2020. He's a real history nerd.
He's a Renaissance man, and he has a girthy knowledge.
Girthy knowledge of history.
Broad knowledge.
Yeah, he really does. We have a great bonus for you on Patreon, patreon.com/TheKatieHelperShow. And you're definitely going to want to do that because this week, Matt Chrisman talks to us a little bit about his youth and what he was into, Civil War history. You can hear the Katie Helper Show on iTunes, where you got to rate and review us. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find me at KT Helps on Twitter.
And you can find me on Twitter at Gabe_Pacheco.
Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. So excited to be talking to Matt Chrisman, who is a member of the Chapo Trap House Collective, the podcast, and also the book.
Yes, that's right.
And you've written for Jacobin also. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of like, I think of you as a kind of a Zinnian. a very accessible historian.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm probably most knowledgeable about. It's what I try to emphasize.
Yeah, well, welcome. And we want to talk about this bonus episode you did about fascism that I thought was so good. And you should like do a series, like the history according to Matt Chrisman or something. But it went through kind of the history of fascism and it pushed back on the horseshoe theory. What I want to know, what like inspired you to do that bonus episode?
Well, the main thing that inspired me was just the fact that because fascism is in people's minds so much, and people are talking about it, and the idea of political street violence is reasserting itself as, you know, a sporadic but real part of American life, that it behooves me to try to offer some sort of clarity, because it does seem, you know, like any concept in America, because we don't really have a sense of history or a knowledge base, that things just sort of get, these terms just sort of get thrown around without any real reference to where they came from or what they mean in any kind of context, alone a historical one. So I just wanted to try to politically ground the idea and talk about the genesis of fascism in interwar Europe. I feel like the episode I did was a good, I thought it did a good job enough of talking about it from the perspective of sort of how it's an instrument of capital.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I kind of missed out on explaining the social base, which I did later. I did a Periscope that I hope to put on YouTube soon that went further into sort of who made up the actual social base as opposed to what capital saw in fascism as sort of an instrument of their power.
Oh, maybe you can do a little bit of that now if you want.
Sure. I talked in the episode, the Chapo episode, about fascism sort of being capitalism's tool to sort of co-opt the politics of the masses that had emerged due to socialism in the late 19th century and create sort of a right-wing popular movement, right, that could then channel all those popular anxieties and angers, especially about political, about economic stress, towards the right and away from the left. But what I talk about in the Periscope thing is about specifically who that was made up of, how the first sort of street fighters of fascism, both in Italy and in Germany, were World War I veterans who had essentially been sort of traumatized, right, out of their ability to interact with the world and civilian life in any kind of healthy way anymore, and responded to that by seeking sort of violence as sort of a way of life. And those were the guys who made up, you know, the black shirts and the brown shirts, and were, they were even in countries that didn't go fascist. They made up the guys who Churchill sent to Ireland in the black and tans to suppress the IRA, and then talked about how the electoral and political base of fascism was the urban middle classes, the sort of the petit bourgeois, the small shopkeepers and professionals whose lives were, they didn't have a sense of class consciousness. They didn't work in sort of, you know, the factory milieu that would have given them that sense of capital as an enemy, but were resentful of finance, and were also resentful sort of the working class culture that they were sort of alienated from, and for whom sort of refocusing anti-capitalism towards specifically Judaism and Jewish control of finance, as opposed to the capitalist class, was an easier sell than it was to the working classes. And of course, the small farmers in the countryside. So that was sort of that was what I felt like I missed in the first one, and I wanted to clarify in the follow-up.
Yeah. Well, you got it. We got it now.
Yeah.
And send it out to the masses. You started out your episode with talking about something I had never heard of. I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it. But you talk about the genocide and concentration camps that happened that under German control of Namibia.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how it relates to what fascism is today? Because I think most people don't know about that.
Well, Germany was one of the later, the last countries of Europe to get a part of the African colonial sort of land grab of the late 19th century. And one of those, they mostly were able to just sort of nibble along at the edges of some places where the British and French hadn't gotten to yet. And the one place they were able to grab was called Southwest, German Southwest Africa, which is current day Namibia, which they claimed in the late 1800s. And then their rule was textbook colonial enterprise of seizing the most valuable land and the most valuable sort of social capital, which there was cattle and livestock, because the Herero tribesmen there were largely herdsmen, and that led to an inevitable conflict with the local tribes. There was a rebellion, and the Germans responded with a campaign of extermination, basically, where they drove them into inhospitable deserts and poisoned any wells so that they wouldn't be able to have access to water. And then when the people who didn't starve sort of surrendered and came back to the settled areas, they actually also rounded them up into camps, and some of the camps actually did the sort of experimentation that would later be done at places like Auschwitz. And that's just part of a general point that fascism, in its mechanism, in terms of what it does at its extreme when it takes power, is it takes the mechanisms that that country used to gain its colonial power and then just turns them on its own citizens in an effort to sort of suppress the left broadly. That's basically the MO of it. Mm-hmm. And talking about what it means today, it does mean that any kind of resurgence, any dangerous resurgence of fascism in the United States is going to have sort of the imprimatur of our military, specifically the army that's been carrying out, now at this point, almost 20 years of sort of brush fire colonial wars in the Middle East and in Afghanistan.
Ooh, okay.
I was just thinking about I was meditating on the idea of what these colonial forces being internalized as opposed to like spread out, what that looks like here. And I just thought about, honestly, I was thinking about charter schools. And I was like, okay, because a charter school that is takes the kids away from their parents, or any ideology where you're like, well, we need to take the kids out of their own communities to help them excel. And working at schools in the Bronx, where I see kids being like, they practice tracking, where they have to make eye contact with the teacher, and they're like castigated if they don't, or they have to walk along straight lines. They have to stay there 6 days out of the week or whatever. And that just makes me think about like our own, like the schools that we put Native Americans in,
right.
Not we, but what the United States would do that sort of.
Yeah. The residential schools.
Yeah. You're trying to scrub, you're trying to alienate kids from their parents and from their communities as the only option to succeed.
Right.
So I don't know. That was a thought I had.
Charter schools. Yeah. Today's fascism. What are the applications that this has? I mean, I know there are a lot, but what is the danger in throwing around the term fascism? Because you talk about, you say, like, to if we want to talk about fascism in a meaningful way or take it seriously, we have to kind of be precise in its use. And there are a lot of people who probably have politics that we agree with who throw the word around or talk about neo-fascism.
I think the danger is just because it comes because fascism sort of arises in a specific context. And I feel like if you use it sort of in exactly, it can make you misdiagnose the moment you're in.
Right.
Because it will make you think, okay, the fascism is here. We are, this conditions are X. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is the real danger and this is another thing I feel like I missed in my Chapo episode. And that I also tried to talk about in the Periscope was that the real context of fascism is when it's not just a crisis. It's not just a moment of economic or social crisis hitting a sort of advanced Western state. It is that happening in also a moment of a powerful mobilized left, because their danger is that this left will be able just through sheer power, numbers to take power. And fascism is a mechanism to prevent that, essentially, by mobilizing a different section of the public along sort of reactionary and nationalist lines, but able to do battle, like in the streets, to the degree that that's a real thing, to sort of assert power in physical space and also at the ballot box. And that is why, like, the current moment, I feel like, we're seeing sort of the beginnings of stirring on both ends, essentially. Mm-hmm. The reemergence of politics, basically, after it took a nap for about 30 years after the 70s. But we are still in a very early stage of that moment. And that's why I think, figuring out exactly what these mechanisms are is important. Like, for example, if we do get some sort of crisis, a real economic crisis in this country that hollows out sort of the already rotting center, in the moment right now where the left is really not there in any kind of real mass sense. It's going to look less like fascism, I would say, than something like than something like Egypt or Pakistan, a thing where it's essentially just a military, direct military rule, right. Direct military or direction of the economy, and without need for mass politics, basically abolishing politics, because we have lived in sort of a post-political moment for so long here in this country, that fascism is best understood as a mass political movement, and we don't have those at all in this country.
So the left would have to be stronger for us to even consider fascism
as like a real mass movement, because we don't have mass politics in this country.
Yeah,
and fascism is above all a mass political project, and in a country like ours right now, there are no mass political projects.
Right. So have we ever had fascism in the United States? Have we been more fascist adjacent?
Well, I mean, that's the old, I mean, that's all once back to that goes back to the whole question of definition.
Right.
There are other definitions of fascism that basically say that, I mean, that when you're talking about any of sort of the post, Great Depression states, you're talking about different grades of fascism, and that the United States military Keynesianism came in after World War II, with its massive wars abroad during, you know, its fight with the Soviets and domestic suppression, COINTELPRO and all that, and the suppression of the mass movements of the 60s, that counted. But as I said, I just feel like it misses the mass political element to really be a meaningful example of it. Yeah. So I'd say that we have had and others, including Robert Faxon, have pointed out that sort of the first proto-fascist movement in America was the post-Civil War Ku Klux Klan.
Mm.
And that if you want to talk about sort of a fascist political moment in American history, it's probably the post-Reconstruction South.
Mm-hmm.
After the troops have been removed following the Compromise of 1877, and the Redeemer Leagues sprung up all over the southern states to basically reverse all of the advances that have been made by freed slaves and remove them from positions of political power and economic and social influence, all along a sort of a paramilitary basis, with the Ku Klux Klan as their sort of exemplary organization. So I'd say that that's probably the closest thing. I mean, once again, it's not fully there because the mass political context that only really makes sense in the terms of sort of the post-Marxists, specifically post-Soviet revolution, array of forces didn't exist, but the elements, the ingredients are there, are in a richer degree than I'd say any other time.
Right. And one of the, I mean, you mentioned Paxton, right, and Stanley Payne.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons it's hard to define fascism is because it's kind of inherently anti-intellectual, and there's no fascist manifesto. I mean, it's like romantic, and it's violent, and it literally means like a group of sticks.
Yes.
In Italian.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just like a heralding back to the Roman Empire.
Yes.
And it makes sense because it's such a violent, thuggish thing that it makes sense that it doesn't have this very intellectually rigorous definition.
I mean, yeah. And not only does it not really have an intellectual tradition, it doesn't really even have a coherent ideology,
right.
And that's on purpose. This is another thing I said on the show, is that it was a postmodern political movement before that was even conceived of, because it was a bunch of essentially cynics and true believers, but true believers in sort of pathological shit like anti-Semitism or whatever.
And PTSD sufferers.
Yeah, who wanted power and were looking for a way to get it. And and so they basically looked at the landscape of post-war Europe, and they looked for where the daylight was, basically. They didn't have a place on the left, but they saw that on the right, the traditional conservative parties were losing support, losing legitimacy, and had no real popular base. But those people who were not really of the left. They were not the people who maybe did not invest the establishment right with legitimacy. They weren't necessarily sort of captured by the left. They were up for grabs, and they identified, okay, like what do we need? Well, we need the mass we need in an era where guys are marching down the streets with all their red flags and shouting, we need a mass face. You can't just be names on a ballot and signs. You have to be in the streets. Like that's the currency of politics at that time.
Yeah.
And so it has to be a mass organization. What do people respond to? Well, they respond to nationalism. That's shown to be to the chagrin of all the Marxist theorizers. Nationalism showed itself to be incredibly resilient and a potent organizer.
People love principle. Their flag.
Oh, they really do. And so, but nationalism, sort of with the laissez-faire economic order, which had been largely discredited by World War One and all of the turmoil afterwards, that wasn't really a sell either. So nationalism fused with sort of a broad critique of capitalism as it was being, you know, exercised then. And they did, honestly, they made the argument, which is still the right-wing argument now, of sort of hardcore libertarians who want to promote free markets but don't want to defend the current order of, well, you're not. That's not capitalism. That's crony capitalism. Only in their mind, the cronies were all Jews. That's how they sort of. That's how they square that circle. And they said capitalism is fine. In fact, capitalism, in a pure sense, is struggle, which is the one of the few things that is a bedrock fascist notion, which is struggle is sort of what makes humans human. And it is sort of the purifying fire that everyone has to go through, and that's on a battlefield, but it's also in business. And so, you know, conquering the heights of competitive commerce is a fascist undertaking if it's done by someone of the nation and not someone sort of using their power of the state behind closed doors.
Choosing.
I was honestly thinking about like the Hillary Clinton campaigns. We were going through like a list of all of the terms that
potential slogans.
Yeah, and they were like fair chance, to get ahead.
Yeah, fair shot.
Yeah,
very meritocracy based.
And all of it was sort of like, well, this foot race, this competition, like we'll all get a chance to struggle equally.
Right. Yes, exactly. Right. And
it's like Russian roulette.
Yeah.
You'll get more slots, empty slots, I guess.
So it was just this grab bag of nationalism, scapegoating, and this sort of critique of capitalism. And that's, of course, where you get the facile Dinesh D'Souza, right. Jonah Goldberg thing of, well, they have socialism in the name, and they consider themselves socialist.
Right.
And there were members of the Nazi Party who sort of
dabbled.
Were disillusioned socialists who had seen sort of the failure of internationalism to overcome national sentiment during World War One, and figured if you can't beat them, join them.
Right.
And this is the way to sort of get to destroy capitalism from within a nation state context, like the Strasser brothers. But what's and
the
this
movie
is,
with Joaquin Phoenix?
Yes. And this is Paxton's point in his book, which analyzes fascism as a not in its rhetoric, but in its actual policies, shows that, well, for one thing, none of that rhetoric stopped them from being supported by big business in Germany.
Right.
They were always bankrolled. And that is what I'm talking about when I say cynical, because that was the big thing holding back. The left broadly had numbers on their side, but they did not have, they had complete and total opposition from the ruling class and the moneyed interests, which obviously, is going to be a huge hindrance. Fascism could see if we ally with big business, if we ally with conventional establishment support and essentially offer them sort of a popular face, then we can avoid attacks from the establishment while continuing to fight in the street and make the appeals, the broad populist appeals that might peel people away from socialism. And you can see that in the fact that after the beer hall putsch to, Hitler, who could have been executed for treason, was given a very light sentence, was out after 2 years, because the establishment did not really view the fascists as a threat, because they were suppressing the people they were really scared of.
So they were a good threat because they were a threat to their the people they saw as a greater
threat. Yeah, I mean, they were not ideal, because any kind of street violence and street organization is nervous making to people in positions of power.
Right.
But it was certainly a better alternative than to letting the streets to the communists.
Right.
And so, like that's sort of the cynical brew that they concocted to gain power. And then, of course, once they were in power, not only did they obviously lock up all of the social democrats and the communists, but they banned unions, and they actually were one of the first regimes, the Nazis, were to experiment with privatization of state interests, like actually returning functions of the state or giving functions of the state over to private contractors. And throughout all of, you know, the Nazi and Italian fascist regimes, no properties were not ever confiscated. Some industries were nationalized during the war effort, of course, but that's sort of par for the course when you're talking about total mobilization. But even in those cases, it was always compensated, and executives and stuff were all like, they maintained the matrix of profit, and they all got access to the profits that the capitalist enterprises made.
So how does this apply to today? The big cliched but important question of history. What are the takeaways? I mean, like, if the diagnosis is so important, which I think it is, that is because, like, to continue the metaphor, we need the correct treatment, right? The correct antibiotics or whatever. So, like, so what is the course of treatment? What is to be done? And what do we call it if it's not fascism? Which, like, what is late capitalism? I don't know. What do we call this era?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're dealing with a prolonged... We're dealing with a prolonged economic crisis shows no real signs of stopping, and every sign of heading towards another collapse. It's just a very odd time. It is genuinely sort of sui generis, because you had this massive collapse in 2008, and we've been in the backwash of it ever since. And politics is consuming people more and more. I mean, like, people are really thinking in political terms almost exclusively. But because of the nature of this social order that we've created through a million things, but mass media being a big part of it, and suburbanization being another huge part, and the destruction of labor unions and the destruction of really public space in general, it's all happening in a context where none of it is translating into a mass politics of any kind. Where people vote, although still not that many. I mean, the massively, you know, these last two elections, we're talking something like 45% to 55% voter turnout.
Right, and that's after massive pushes.
Right, exactly. So not that many people vote, and the people who do fixate on politics largely confine their activities around it towards personal expression.
Right.
Online, or, you know, mostly online. And so it's this weird ersatz war that's largely being fought on the internet. And there are, of course, it is spilling over into public, of course, things like, you know, the Charlottesville and...
Making it Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
Making the Jews.
Yeah, and Antifa and, you know, street fights, but... There is sort of a weird cosplay sort of ersatz quality to it, because you aren't talking about the sort of mass mobilizations that you would expect with this degree of passion. You're still right. Talking about relatively small groups of people in any absolute sense. And so that's why it's hard really for me to draw a lot of real inferences, just because this era feels so oddly... isolated, mm-hmm. sort of in historical terms, because the pervading social modes and pervading economic conditions are really unique in American history.
But don't people say that all, like, isn't that, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same? Like, I think people often think that in the moment, right, that we're in an unprecedented era.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean they're wrong or you're wrong, but I guess yeah, I don't know. Then, of course, the other question is, what is to be?
Yeah, and that's the hardest one, of course. And the easy, glib answer is that mass politics on the left has to become a real thing again. And that needs to happen probably in the context of some sort of broad, I don't know, something like the Chartists. An agenda. And this is hard because we don't really think of politics as about issues, even though that is what we get upset about.
Right.
They all get filtered through personalities.
Right.
And that, I think, is if that continues to be the case, I don't see anything changing really, because as we saw during this last election, I mean, the people who are supposed to be on the left as electoral the electoral option for people are not going to do it. They're not going to inspire people. They're not going to make them shed their, at this point, hardened cynicism and lack of faith in these institutions, because they're part of these sort of moribund political parties that no one really has any trust for anymore. And so, like, the closest thing to an answer I can think of, and it's obviously very, you know, rudimentary, is, and that needs to get worked on by people smarter than me, is that there needs to be sort of a easy to understand bullet point policy that sort of has to be a litmus test for all candidates, right, that you would support, and which has to be first, that has to go in ahead of personalities,
right,
that like it that has to be sort of leading, that has to be the horse leading the wagon,
not the other way around.
Not the other way around.
Except so, right? Except we're not going to reinvent the wheel, right?
Yeah,
wagons. And yeah, for all of, I mean, for recent history, personalities and individuals and leaders have galvanized people and led movements. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the important things aren't done by the movement and people behind the scenes. But it seems like we're not going to be able to deprogram people from looking towards a figure.
Yeah.
So then the question is, of course, who is the figure? And of course, I always go towards Saint Bernard. Mm-hmm. But if we came up with the litmus test, what does that litmus test look like? And is it a litmus test that anyone could pass right now? Any politicians?
I mean, I think it could. The task of sort of formulating that is going to be up to the people. I mean, it basically comes down to what draws the response. Like, what do people turn towards? What do you know, the what sort of makes people turn their head and reckon with something,
mm-hmm,
and maybe, you know, stop sort of their stop what they're doing, basically, and take a look. Something that can, you know, get them to keep listening to a canvas or a phone call or, right, something like that. And obviously, I think healthcare is a big part of,
right,
it. Healthcare is huge. And I think that the movement on that is very good. And I think it should be the leading edge of anything, because I think you got to start a conversation. And that's a good way to start it with many, many people, because it's a travesty and everyone knows someone, right, or has personally been injured or you know, traumatized by interactions, yeah, with the healthcare system.
Although there's a very good propaganda machine that claims that people come from Canada and Europe, and there are all these lines,
yeah,
and you know that I'm always amazed by how strong that is. So that's another thing that we have to.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is the pushback's going to be huge.
Yeah.
There's no, and it has only really just begun,
right,
because you know, you don't really have, you barely have model legislation, and you don't have control of. I mean, until recently, you haven't even had control of a legislature to maybe even symbolically pass, yeah, something. And have it like put out there, but I mean, we saw during the midterms that healthcare passed basically everywhere it was on the ballot, and if it's, that's the kind of an example of the idea stripped of its relationship to a political party or to a candidate, is incredibly popular.
Right.
It's once you have to have that coming out of the mouth of somebody who has a D next to their name.
What about an I?
I mean, that's better, certainly. Like, that's the funniest thing about people who get mad about Bernie not being,
yeah,
a Democrat. They don't realize that that is his single best
right, attribute.
Right,
I know. You're like, I already love him. You don't have to sell him on me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the Democratic Party is just an absolutely garbage brand.
Right.
It is a hindrance. Being a member of it, forgetting about the psychos who hate the Democrats because they actually think they're communists.
Right.
They're just regular people who don't necessarily engage in politics. They don't see them as a champion for anything other than their own interests, and for good reason.
Right.
So I think that just showed that the healthcare is an important like leading issue, and it kind of can, it shows how it can energize, maybe, you know, and energize people, engage people who might otherwise not be interested in the partisan aspect of it because,
right,
of their sort of alienation from that entire,
yeah,
charade.
So what are your takeaways from the midterm and then your predictions for 2020?
Well, it was a crazy mixed bag. I mean, that's the thing. Like, there's really no clear. I didn't really draw a clear inference from anything. I mean, there was good results. There were bad results. There's really a data point for anything you want to, any argument you want to make.
Right. That,
you know, because there were plenty of people running in the red districts on healthcare who lost, right. Which, you know, is could be used as an example. But then there were people who ran on red districts on healthcare won.
Right.
So, I mean, the specific terrain of the districts probably has more to do with that than any kind of broader argument you want to make. I say that you're going to get 2 years of probable deadlock, which is certainly preferable than what we've had so far.
Right.
And then in 2020, oh, man, I don't know. I certainly hope. I do think Bernie is really the only choice for the Democrats.
Yeah.
Just keep him alive. Yeah. I want to see images of Bernie doing planks.
Yeah, they need to have him like in. Yeah. They need to just keep him in that chamber from Starship Troopers for the next 2 years. And then wheel him around in it for the campaign.
He's so fit. Oh, come on.
He's fitter than I am. There's no question about it.
P90X Bernie.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I would like to see him and the crowded field, I think, works to his advantage.
Right.
But you know, it's all a question of how quickly it's whittled down and if there's like an establishment stop Bernie
right.
consensus candidate early enough in the process that right. they might be able to
if
stop
there's him. Another viable candidate to lose to Trump.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing. And that's the thing. If the economy, I mean, we've seen this before. You know, this was a big swing in the House, but it's not that off of par for what you see in a midterm. And it was probably a lot of the bleeding was a lot more bleeding was probably staunched by the continue overheated, you know, economy, which is going to pop.
Right.
And it really just comes down to whether or not it happens before 2020. If there's some sort of slump or recession before 2020, I think anybody could probably Trump.
Mm.
But if the economy just keeps going, then I think he might actually win. And then he gets to preside over Hoovervilles for the next 4 years after that. And we can have another, we can redo the Hoover term all over again with Trumpvilles and the bonus army. It'll be great.
What do you think of what happened in Brazil?
Well, I talked about this on our show as sort of to show how Brazil is an example of actual what we would the closest thing we have now to a fascist takeover, using the electoral system, a mass street-based violent movement that has the tacit and in many cases explicit endorsement of the traditional elite who basically wanted to end the left,
right.
Who were sick of the Workers' Party, used administrative coup to remove Rousseff, mm-hmm. used the courts to prevent Lula from running, who would have won.
Yeah,
and Lula would have won. But were unable to win themselves. I mean, the Temer, the establishment replacement for Rousseff at like 2% approval rating. There was no real popular support for any of the remaining right-wing parties, so a new force had to come in to fill that void, and that was Bolsonaro, and then he used those tactics to win, and that is the contrast to the United States, where you did have a legitimate alliance between a mass fascist violent street movement and the traditional elites who won at the ballot box, thanks in large part to the helpful machinations of the bureaucracy. And that really is the contrast with the U.S. because we don't have something like that happening here yet. But that is sort of the future we can look forward to in a era of more mass politics and more social and economic crisis.
And shout out, of course, to the Wall Street Journal for endorsing Bolsonaro.
Of course. Amazing.
Yeah, the safest choice.
He's not PC, but he'll get things done.
Yeah. That actually surprised me. I mean, it was kind of a reminder of how much more overtly... because the Wall Street Journal will never endorse Trump, right? And it's just so much easier for them to be reactionary and embrace totally despicable policies abroad than it is here.
Well, yeah, publicly. Because nobody really knows anything about those countries, so they're not going to be horrified by it.
Yeah. I just thought maybe that, yeah, I was surprised. Everyone else was like, why are you surprised? It's to be expected. But it was taking off the mask. But you're right. If no one knows what's behind the mask, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So do you think that a Bolsonaro type character would be the future here if there was an economic crisis after Trump?
I mean, we're seeing the trajectory. I mean, from Palin, you know, from sort of the ersatz nationalism of the Bush era to Sarah Palin running in 2008 and then Trump. I mean, it's a pretty the anti-intellectualism gets cranked up. The partisan
anti-intellectualism.
Anti-intellectualism.
I missed it.
Gets cranked up. Sort of the appeal to violence gets cranked up. The fetishization of force. The rallies get more body and violent.
Right.
And if you want to just keep going, it does seem like that's an inevitable, the inevitable result.
We've got the rise above type white nationalist street fighters,
mm-hmm.
which are, they seem small at this point. And then there's the Proud Boys.
Yes.
But, who's going to be the Fry Corps? Because they don't seem like...
No. I'd say that the groups, I mean, unless it's somebody new, and it would probably be somebody new.
Yeah.
But the group that seems like it would be the core of that, if it were to happen among existing groups, and like I said, it would probably be a new group that we haven't even imagined yet, I would say the 3%ers. Because those guys, and the Oath Keepers... Those guys are military men. These guys are the veterans. These guys are sort of that thing the Fry Corps, the guys who have been traumatized by their encounter with colonial violence and now are coming home and sort of can't really adjust anymore. I'd say like that is the model for whoever it would end up being.
So on the other end, anyone who's a progressive pouring resources and money into veteran VA hospitals mm-hmm. and veteran care and reintegration into society, that would be positive to staunch any more fascist tendencies.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's like the real, one of the dark ironies of contemporary conservatism is their fetishization of the troops as an abstract and then their absolute willingness to sort of leave them to the wolves when they get home. And
right.
Then, the guy who did the shooting in California was a 5-year veteran of the Marines, diagnosed with PTSD.
Right.
That's like the colonial chickens honestly coming home to roost in a way that is a hallmark of fashion.
But how much do people... think that that's, I mean, it's probably not conscious, but I wonder if the people who fetishize the military, whether they care about these occasional, examples of gun violence, massacres, what have you. Do they just think that's like a worthy cost of the military projects?
Oh, yeah.
Right? They don't really, it's like the chickens coming home to roost, but they don't even see it that way.
No, that's the thing.
Unless one of their kids is...
If anything, it helps them. And that's true of terrorism, too. Like, the military state never really cared if there was terror attacks. Those are good.
They
encourage, they give people more commitment to maintaining a military posture.
Yeah. Great for Israel.
Yeah, it's a negative feedback loop that just, to them, is totally welcome.
Right. So... two other questions, two other areas I'd love to talk about with you. One is the idea of there is this parallel of it's not a horseshoe as in they're comparable in terms of the right and the left, like socialism and fascism, but it does, they do compete for similar populations sometimes. And you have often been accused of being of courting alt-right people. To me, it seems like there's a really good thing in offering potential, in offering disaffected would-be alt-right people another outlet. But then people are like, you shouldn't be catering to these people at all. It's kind of suggesting that in order to get them, you have to be offering something
alt-rightish.
Yeah, and I don't think we are at all. The only thing that we're offering, I think, that you that some people would call alt-rightish, is that we sort of aren't censored. We don't censor ourselves. We are
irreverent.
I hate the phrase un-PC, right. But like we are willing to sort of ride the edge on right. comedy, and that is a thing that separates us from other sort of media things, and also does appeal to. Because it's demographically, it's the same guys. It's right, young, right. underemployed white guys. Right. I mean, that's who listens to us. That's who ends up becoming alt-right. And there is an element to which, you know, especially the degree to which they're online, which is extremely,
right.
That they feel alienated by right. a culture that talks about scolding them yeah. for being white and,
yeah,
and
not
telling them
your
they
privilege.
Can't say things and yeah. stuff like that. And so, since there's so little material basis to American politics and right. all that they recognize is sort of the rhetoric, they got one side of them saying, yeah, we'll say whatever we want, hell yeah. And then another side saying, no, you can't say right. anything. And I'm like, well, all right, what are you offering me other than the chance to feel bad about myself? Right.
Yeah.
And so...
You don't want the toxic masculinity pill? Right.
Exactly. And so... I think that, I mean, we have never tried to cater to anybody.
Right.
I mean, we've never had a plan, trust
right.
me. We just kind of talk about what we're thinking about.
Yeah.
And I think that what we've done is we've created a space where people can kind of have that
right.
that jocularity, but then also at every point we hammer out the fact that what's alienating you and what's making your life a sort of a barren desert of sort of either you know, lack of purpose or precarity or both is capitalism.
Jews.
Not the Jews.
Not Muslims. Not Mexicans.
Not the Muslims. Not
black people. Not the gays.
Not the people with the least amount
right.
of power in the society.
Right.
The people with the most.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not. I actually find the argument so facile and so stupid that if you are peeling people away from a potentially from the alt-right, you're somehow doing something alt-right. Seems like a no-brainer that, I'm not saying this to blow smoke up your ass. I think this applies to any movement, any party, any candidate, any pop culture phenomenon that is providing people with something that they get from the alt-right without the alt-right part. Like, it's the Bernie Trump thing, right?
Yeah.
It's tapping into the same group of people
right.
and saying, no, don't blame these people. You're fucked, and I feel that you're fucked, and I get it.
Yeah.
But go this way, not that way.
Yeah. I think a lot of people online on the left, like they feel like they sort of have a monopoly on virtue. Yeah.
Right.
And like the idea that somebody who, you know, has aesthetic preferences that they don't like could also be on their side is offensive to them.
Right.
They don't like that. It's like, no, I have this perfectly curated personality in this perfectly curated Netflix queue, and
right.
I like all the right music, and it's
right.
like it's not fair for some fucking cargo short bro
right.
to be on my side.
You can like Cannibal Corpse and Trotsky,
right?
Right. Yeah, I mean it's kind of like it's not a bad problem to have, you know,
yeah.
to feel like there are too many people,
right?
Like,
well,
cramping your style.
People have
God
said
forbid.
This is that like the left, because of its lack of popular impact and success, has become just a subculture. It's a subculture. It's sort of an identity.
Right.
And if it's an identity, then you know you want to. It's like being a goth in high school.
Right.
You know, you don't want posers.
Right. 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 Yeah.
And that's not a way to ever. That's a recipe Build. For irrelevance for
right.
eternity.
Yeah.
If that's the metric, you know, you're never gonna. Do it because the politics is about getting more people.
Right, right, right.
You can
yeah.
like you can like unions and not like folk rock.
Yeah,
yeah.
You don't have to think Nanette was great.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Although that probably is a litmus test for some people.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a one woman show.
Yeah.
It's not stand-up.
Yeah. It's, what did you call it? Slam poetry, spoken word.
Close.
Yeah. I don't really get that. It just seems so illogical. That argument, also the argument that like class. Organizing can't work because people are racist. I'm sure you've encountered
oh,
that.
Oh, God, yeah. Can well, you- that's, I mean, the what I wish people who push that would really accept, I really wish they would accept, if you believe that to be the case, then you can't ever win.
Right.
Because you're not going to have enough people.
Right.
If every white person in America is racist, except for the ones who've gone through the proper, you know, privilege checking detox program.
Retreat, yeah.
Yeah, you bought the safety pin box.
Yeah,
or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're never going to win anything.
Right.
Because you don't have enough people.
Right.
So you're just complaining. You're just posting.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, that's fine, but you need to accept that. You need to like be like the Afro-pessimist thing, right? Where you just say, there's no hope for any of this.
Exactly,
I'm just going to post. Pretending like you should be a, like claiming a mantle of like a gatekeeper for a political project when you are at base fundamentally as black-pilled, pardon the term, as like a, as like Elliot Rogers, that's absurd.
Yeah.
You are embracing a politics of inevitable and complete defeat.
Yeah. And it's purity politics. That's the irony, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like they always accuse us of purity politics. Like you're literally saying that what you are promoting is abandoning any viable victory, any potential victory. And that's more important than the lives of the people who you claim to care about.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, that's what kills me. It's like, if you care about racism, sexism, homophobia, I won't say classism because they don't pretend to. But if you care about these marginalized people and disenfranchised people, you think the best way to defeat, to empower them or protect them is by making sure that people like Trump stay in office?
Yeah. Because that's the inevitable byproduct of all of this.
And you can't, when you ask people, like, so that there's that argument, and that goes hand in hand with the argument that class policies throw marginalized people under the bus. And when you ask people what they're talking about, they don't ever have a response.
No.
Because they don't.
Yeah.
Like, everything that's good for the white working class is good for everything that we're proposing, or the left is proposing, that's good for the white working class is good for the working class of all genders and colors.
And disproportionately.
And exactly. It's not just
better.
Good for them. It's disproportionately.
It's better.
Exactly.
It's disproportionately better for, for all struggling
minorities
and white
women. So these are the racists and sexists.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
It's,
at least
true.
In the result, I mean, they are. Like, they may have a cool view on things, but they're the ones who are, literally, if we followed their political advice, we are like condemning people to what?
To continued rule by this psychotic right. And I think, you know, to give them sort of to give them a little bit of credit, I honestly think that they don't even think in those terms. Like, I was talking about how like that's how deeply ingrained irrelevance is on the left.
Right.
That when you
yeah,
say,
it's true.
Well, you know, what?
Of course, you're not gonna,
what about doing this? Right. What about like they don't think anything's going to happen. So it's like,
it's a
that's
moot
not
point.
Persuasive to them, because what, you think your thing's going to happen? Nothing is going to happen.
Right. Although, why not? If nothing's going to happen, like, why not actually try to work on things that help people disproportionately?
I mean, part of it is you lose your gatekeeper status, which is, you know, a big thing. Like, you have a position within sort of a hierarchy of people online who sort of defer to you on these issues.
Right.
And if you get a broader group, And the issues that people are emphasizing aren't your specialty, your specific influence gets diluted. And like, that is much more of a real threat than the promise of something happening that you probably don't even think is even possible. So much better to protect your specific gatekeeper position.
Yeah, we had Leslie Lee on, and he made this point, you know, about how this paper had come out saying that Trump voters were all animated by racism or racial animus.
Yeah.
And that was somehow new or something. And he said, he's like, we and you, all the people posting about this, have always been saying that white people are racist. Why is this a surprise? And Obama, and he says it's still no excuse for losing to Trump. Obama was able to win over some of these people.
Yeah.
And he goes, Hillary Clinton, as a racist herself, should have had an easier time.
And get this, Hillary voters were racist too.
Oh, right, exactly. That was the other point he made.
Plenty
exactly.
of racists voted for Hillary Clinton.
What was it, the Pumas?
Oh, yeah.
Because I mean, you have guys who voted for Obama and then they voted for Trump. And they get mad at you if you say, well, they couldn't have been that racist because they voted for Obama. But a lot of those people also voted for Hillary, and they, like, they've done polling on racial views of the people who voted for. There's a good solid chunk of Clinton voters, white Clinton voters, who had every horrible retrograde view and still voted for her. So that's not the idea that they've created this like clear indicator based on whether or not you voted for this profoundly uncharismatic, insanely corrupt wife of a rapist is not very persuasive.
Right. Oh, yeah. We should talk about Juanita Broderick. That's a whole other thing. That's actually another interesting thing. The Juanita Broderick thing, just quickly, like, I think that's an example of the left. I see these things as kind of related. Like, when we alienate people and crap on them, we're losing them. And Juanita Broderick, it's not like, she's a very specific example. She was raped by Bill Clinton. But liberal feminists did not pay attention to her. Donald Trump swoops in, offers her a chance to tell her story. Like, I'm not saying I blame or don't blame the person. It's very logical to me, though. If you've been ignored or called a liar or called crazy for decades, then someone gives you a chance to tell your story.
Yeah.
You do it. And that to me is like almost a metaphor for what happens. Like, if we don't fight for certain people, it creates a vacuum and then people go elsewhere.
Yeah. But the thought is that, and this goes like, and it comes from every element of the way they talk about everything, is that your allegiance is owed without right. any sort of promise of support or offer of anything. Like, you are supposed to support them because that's what makes you a good person.
Right. Oh,
and
yeah.
If you don't, then you're bad. Like, that's why after every vote, every election, whenever they lose, they fixate on the people who voted for third parties
right.
because they want to yell at these people who probably never would have voted
anyway,
for a Democrat
right.
anyway. Like, it's amazing. In Arizona, the Green Party candidate pulled out.
Right. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
She saw how close it was.
Who's also a black woman, which is yes. inconvenient for the narrative, by the way.
Pulled out of the race. And it's still a number of people voted for her, and in a close contest, it might have been, you know, enough. But if you're voting for the Green Party candidate after she's
right.
pulled out
yeah,
of the
you're
race,
probably not that,
you're not
yeah.
gettable.
Right. Exactly.
And they don't
yeah.
think of it. They don't realize
they never,
that.
Yeah.
They assume that these people are owed them, just as they're assumed all women are
right.
owed them, all minorities
right.
are owed them.
The firewall.
Nobody
yeah.
has to. They don't have to get
compete,
anything back.
Right.
They, yeah. You can shit on them all the time.
Right.
And they're still supposed to support you because it makes them good people.
I also wonder how many people are potentially lost that way ahead of time, because people always prep shit on people, right? So even before the election, people start blaming third party people. People start blaming the Greens. I wonder how much that actually alienates people who would be gettable.
I mean, it's part of a broader
right.
just imperiousness.
Yes.
And they just, as the party itself, I've heard other people say this. I said it on a show. It's like, if Coke starts losing to Pepsi, they don't go, "Why aren't you drinking more Coke, you fucking assholes?"
Yeah,
they
yeah,
say,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
"Oh, what are we doing that they're not
right.
drinking our beverage
yeah.
anymore?"
That's so funny.
And
to focus
and the thing is, the reason for that is because that's what you have control over, is what you are offering as a party.
Right.
You don't have control over
right.
individual action.
Right, right, right.
You think you can yell at them, but that's just you getting like a libidinal thrill from
yeah,
scolding
exactly.
somebody.
Yeah.
You're not actually going to change
which
their
probably makes
by
them double down.
Them. We know
yeah.
for a fact that doesn't work.
Right.
It just makes you feel better. You have no control over the actions of
right.
a handful of third-party voters. You have control over what you offer.
Right.
And maybe that gets them. Maybe it doesn't. These people are probably not gettable, but maybe it gets somebody else.
Yeah.
Maybe it gets people who don't vote. And that's the reality, is this
right.
giant chunk of totally disengaged Americans who have decided that politics doesn't mean anything to them, and seeing what the party that's supposed to be the party of working people fail to offer them any meaningful redress and then blame the voters for their failures is not going to make them change their mind.
Yeah. Amen. This was great, though.
No, this is a lot yeah. of fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So where can people find you? What's next for you? What's now that you've written a book?
Yes, we got the Chapel Guide to Revolution.
Yeah.
We're still keep on keeping on rock and rolling, baby.
Yeah. Rock and roll tour.
Well, we just got back from touring,
right.
so we're going to take a few months off. We're hoping to tour though next year. We have ambitious plans to tour the UK.
Ooh, nice.
And the South, which we haven't
Ooh.
Gotten to yet. And then also
to a Gettysburg concert.
Yeah. I mean, Shiloh. I've never been to Shiloh. I'd like to check that out. And we did our election stream, which was a big success.
Yeah.
And then we're going to try to do more stuff on the Twitch stream, like, you know, panel stuff and program, like visual video program,
right.
put stuff on more YouTube stuff. So just trying to get cross platform, shenanigans.
Nice.
So that's the near future.
Yeah. You got to help us out with Twitch.
Yeah,
man.
We want to do it. Yeah,
I have no idea how to do it. It's all our producer Chris. God bless him.
And remember, just take a stroll down memory lane. I remember that first night, that fateful night.
Yes, that's true.
When we did live taping with you guys,
our first appearance on camera anywhere.
Yeah,
and the first time I met Felix.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh wow. So you guys were extremely online.
Yeah.
Friends
yeah, we were just online
that.
Friends. I'd never met him before that trip.
I'm a matchmaker.
Absolutely.
What can I say? And I remember, I think you said, it was very cute. I don't remember if you said it online or to me or whatever. You're like, this is the, and I'm sure it's been surpassed. You're like, this is the best night of my life.
You know what? I mean, we've had some great experiences ever since then, but like the feeling, that first feeling of going into that room and having it full of people after we were just like talking into the void for like 4 months, that has yet to be surpassed, honestly. That was amazing. So thank you guys for giving us that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
No, it was our pleasure.
Yeah. Well, thanks guys.
So happy we could give you that Katie Halpershow bump from obscurity to fame. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Come back on. Thanks so much for listening to the Katie Halper Show. Don't forget to check out our bonus with
Matt Chrisman.
Go to patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show.
Yep. And find us on all the social media platforms.
Facebook. We got the Katie Halper Show Facebook. You got to use the KT Halp Show hashtag all over. So that's KTHALPSHOW. You could tag the streets with it. Why not? Gabe, where can people find you?
People can find me every week at Pete's Candy Store on Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. doing stand-up with my co-host Samir Nassim. You can also find me on Twitter at Gabe_Pacheco, or check out a movie review podcast, Eat, Pray, Judge.
And you can check me out on Twitter. That's KT Halps, letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. You can also find me on Instagram with the same name. You have a different name on Instagram, right?
It's Gabe Pack One.
Gabe Pack One. You can find the Katie Halper Show on iTunes, SoundCloud.
Rate and review, and subscribe.
Yeah, tell your friends and family. Thanks, guys. Bye.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.